It's fascinating because there's, for so long now in the Mafia, been this code of silence where people inside the mob were told specifically, do not speak to the police, quite obviously. But it seems to me that in the past couple of decades, you've had more and more people come out willing to speak to the law enforcement and authorities in return for amnesty.
It's one of the biggest mob busts in years. More than 40 suspected mob members were arrested in a massive bust that spanned five states, allegedly involving four major New York City crime families.
They were involved in casino-style clubs, credit card fraud, health care fraud, firearms trafficking, and arson.
One suspect was accused of ordering an associate to attack a panhandler outside his restaurant and, quote, break his knees. Among the suspects arrested, many colorful nicknames like Tony the Cripple, Mustache Pat, and Nicky the Wig.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler, also writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and advocate and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
And today we have a very special guest, my longtime great friend, Vince Giacci. How you doing, Vince?
Jim, I'm fine. How are you doing?
Great. So, Vince, we are here to talk about Mob Shot with Vince Giacci, and that's you. Lisa, you want to read the description of Mob Shot with Vince Giacci?
Okay. So Vince Giacci wanted to be a made guy. From the time he left the brutality of upstate New York's Caxackie Reformatory, he worked for wise guys, committing armed robberies, collecting for the mob, and dreaming of the day that he would get his button. He never made it into the mob's inner sanctum. Why? He was too crazy and too violent. Hooked on drugs and alcohol, Vince was a loose cannon, so dangerous that his own crew considered taking him out. So this is his story told in his voice. It's a story of a guy who, by all rights, should be dead or in prison today. Come along for the ride in a story of true crime like you've never heard it before. Wow.
So, Vince, just to give you an opportunity to explain, this is you telling stories in that time, in that headspace that you were in. But you've got to change life now, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. My life today is, I wouldn't even steal a piece of chewing gum, you know. I was a major thief. You know, I used to steal in front of you to watch your eyes while I was stealing from you. And I can't do any of that stuff now.
So we don't talk about this to sort of make light of those crimes, but to show, hopefully, behind the scenes how and why, what motivated you, what was going on in your brain at the time. And then, of course, how the redemption happened, how you turned around and became a good citizen of the United States of America.
Yeah, that was back then. I was born actually in Little Italy on the Village. And it's ironical because my grandmother used to tell me stories about Vito Genovese. I mean, she told me some stories about the night that Vito Genovese had this guy thrown off the roof so that he could marry the guy's wife. And my grandmother seen the guy fly off the roof, and she became good friends with Vito Genovese's mother, who was a little peasant lady. But my grandmother knew all those guys. In that neighborhood, they all respected the little people. And my grandmother held a lot of respect. My grandmother was a tough little lady. My mother and father, they said, you know, we can't raise this kid in this neighborhood because they're all gangsters. And there's a chance he might get shot on his way up. So they moved up to 51st Street.
Were you an only child?
I was an only child, and my mother never let me forget it because she almost died having me. So every time I did something wrong, she reminded me.
A gentle reminder.
Yeah,
Gotta love motherly love.
Gotta
That's
love
amazing.
Them old timers, yeah.
But they wanted to move out of the neighborhood because they wanted
They moved up to 51st Street, and it was funny because 51st Street, one side was the tenements, the middle class people, and the other side was the rich with the elevated apartments. So I managed to, you know, hang out in the streets with my friends, and there were older guys in the neighborhood, tough guys, and they tortured us. They they made sure to torture us every day. And
to get respect? Or
no, I don't know. I think in the end they wanted to toughen us up because when we got older, they let us hang out with them, you know. But they used to do all kinds of things, putting us in a delivery wagon, roll us down the hill with traffic coming. We didn't know they were behind us. I mean, we're thinking the cars are going to hit us. They throw us in a cellar and, you know, they had these walk-in cellars and they closed the grating and they jump up and down so all the rust would fall on your head and there were rats down there. And
what sort of age were you when this
was
happening?
I was about 8 or 9 then, you know, and it was brutal, you know, and not only that, I went to school and I got bullied in school by the older kids. So I'm bullied in school. I'm trying to get out of school without getting beat up. And then I shoot into the neighborhood and I'm trying to get home without the big guys seeing us.
You're trying to survive in both.
I was surviving. Environments. Talk about school. What school? I was in fear all the time. And what changed the whole thing is there was a certain guy that was older than us. I was like at the time 13, something like that. And he was about 16. And he always pushing me around, pushing my friends around, real bully. And one day I exploded. And I tore into him like a maniac. And I was a skinny little kid, but I could hit. I had a pretty good punch, and I beat the living shit out of this guy. I mean, real bad. After that punch, my whole life changed after that.
As in no one would victimize you again?
But the older guys started wanting me to hang out with them.
Really?
And
so you kind of proved your worth.
Oh, then that was the worst thing that ever happened because I was a student of becoming a criminal.
But at that time, you didn't think it was the worst thing. You thought it was the greatest thing, right?
Oh, are you kidding me? I emulated them, the way they wore their hair, the way the peg pants, the whole nine yards. One of them had a car, and we'd go in the car, and I was introduced to girls at a very early age. You know, it was this one guy, JR, he was having sex with this girl, and he calls me into the room. I was a little kid.
How old?
I'm around 13, something like that. And he says to me, why don't you grab her? I said, grab her. I didn't even know what a girl looked like. You know, and once you get a taste of that, man, I was off and ready to the racetrack, you know. And I was doing pretty good for a 14-year-old kid. I had a lot of girls, you know, and I was a good dancer. So that attracted girls. And then I was crazy, which attracted crazy girls. So all the way around.
Wow. Well, speaking of crazy, why don't we tell people how we met?
Okay. I have a dear friend. His name is Tony Denison, and Tony's a phenomenal actor. I mean, it's funny because he's a very gentle person in real life, and nobody can play a mob guy like this guy.
Yeah.
You know, our show in New York was Crime Story, and we emulated watching him. In fact, I watched a few of his moves and I picked up on it. You know, I said, you know, don't show too much emotion. He had no emotion and he was killing people left and right.
That's in Crime Story, yeah.
Oh, and then he played John Gotti, and I've seen him in other crime films too. The guy is phenomenal he plays a mob guy. In fact, now he's doing a show called Major Crimes where he plays an Irish detective.
Right.
And he's phenomenal in that too. You know, he's just a great actor and he's a dear friend, you know. I mean, I've known Tony for a good 18 years now and I love the guy.
So Tony introduced you?
Oh, yeah. So yeah. Tony...
that's the common ground is Ray Luca, because I met Tony in 2005 on the set of Criminal Minds when he was playing a SWAT sergeant.
Right.
And I had told the director that, oh, my God, that's Ray Luca.
Yeah.
And he said, no, it isn't. It's Tony Denison. I said, yeah, but he's Ray Luca.
Ray Luca, right.
I said, I used his name as an undercover name when I was in the FBI. And Tony walks up and says, hey, I heard you use my name in the FBI undercover. He's like, what's up with that? And then he's like, nah, I mean, that's great. That's awesome.
Well, you know, the funny part about it is I was in New York at the time, and I was a little criminal. But I had come out to the West Coast, a little vacation, and I was in this... Italian, like a deli on Colorado by the beach. And I run in, and who do I see? He's sitting down with his, I guess, producer or writer, Tony Denison.
Really?
And I was like a groupie. I went up to him. I said, you're on Crime Story. You know, he was very humble. And I said, Jesus. So I went back to the neighborhood, and I said, guess who I fucking met?
That's awesome.
He's a very, and you know, we're involved in the same life right now, me and him. And, you know, it's a life of helping people today. You know, I've been involved in a 12-step program now for 29 years, and it turned my whole life around. When my daughter was born, and I've helped a lot of young kids. You know, they love all that mob shit, but, you know, that's how you get them in, by talking to them and telling them there's a better way of life than becoming a criminal and being incarcerated. You know,
you use it to educate people.
Well, I've spoken in rehab centers. I've spoken at Chino, and I've spoken at the...
That's great. Well, obviously, and that's sort of a major theme of what we want to talk about today is
right.
The redemption part. And
right.
The way you found a way back from the edge.
Right.
Because you...
Well, from the darkness.
Yeah, he
sounds
was...
Sounds like a lot of darkness.
Well, they
you,
say...
You were doing some pretty crazy stuff.
Well, they say a cat's got 9 lives, and I surpassed that.
Really?
I mean, if you listen to this podcast, there's about 10 incidents there between overdoses, car crashes, getting arrested, getting shot. I mean, my own crew wanted to throw me in the East River.
Didn't you jump over a wall and
oh,
not know
yeah.
what was on the other
oh,
side?
Listen to this. See, you know, it's funny, but this thing with the mob thing, it was like I would escalate myself to be in favor with these bad guys. And, hey, he's doing great. And then I'd do drugs and alcohol and go down to the basement again. And this time I was starting to use heroin. And this is a story. It would have said to me today, what are you, out of your fucking mind? I said, You got a problem with your life. But, you know, it didn't work that way. So I go up to, it was like on the west side. So I went up this tenement and I wanted to score 2 nickel bags of heroin. And I was going to take the heroin home, bang it, you know, and feel all right, you know. So I go, I'm walking down from the brownstone. There's a cops are there. Hey, kid, come over here. And I said, sure. And I went to go over to the car, and I made a right-hand turn, and I took off like the roadrunner. I was pretty fast in those days.
What kind of age were you here?
Oh, my God. See what I'm saying? This was like I had already gotten out of Caxsackie. You know, I was about 20.
Pretty young
20,
still?
27, 25, you know. So I ran. I made the corner, and I could hear the sirens behind me. I made the corner. I made the next corner. And as I made the next corner, as I'm running around the corner, I see a wall. It's a wall about 3 feet high. And I figure I'll scale the wall, and I'm going to hide behind the wall, and they'll shoot right by me. Well, I jumped the wall. The wall was 3 stories down.
The other side of the wall was 30 feet high.
Drop.
Yes.
And I had no idea.
I tried to break my fall, and I hit my head. And if it wasn't snow on the ground, I probably would have been dead. And I'm laying there, and I'm all busted. My head is bleeding, and that's what I did. I took the 2 nickel bags. Mm. I crawled into a little alley space. I snorted the heroin. I stayed there all night in the freezing cold. And, you know, I think of that today, and I think of, boy, what a – boy, you really were messed up, you know.
And, to survive that. Is...
Yeah, and so, you know, the thing – a girl in the program says to me, you know what saved your life? Because I would have got made. I had a big set of cuñones, man, and I'd do anything. And I was a good moneymaker. My violence behind drinking and coke prevented me from getting made. A girl in the program said to me, she says, I bet you're still pissed off you didn't get made. I said, well, I should have got made. She says, you should be grateful to God that you didn't get made. If it wasn't for drugs and alcohol, you can thank drugs and alcohol. You're not getting made. And look at your life today. So I'm thinking...
That's really ironic.
It's very ironic, yeah.
I'm thinking drugs and alcohol saved my life.
So could you just
explain what getting made means? I mean,
all right.
we've all watched all the...
Okay, here's
that
what
stuff.
Happens. You know, when you're a kid, they send you... They make you do things like... They test to see if you're a tough guy. They test to see if you can take care of yourself, and they test to see if you're a snitch or if you can, you know, take a trimming, and they watch you. And I was doing stuff with this couple of guys downtown, and they sent me sometimes to run some numbers, and after a while they even sent me to collect money for what happens is they watch you and they groom you. And in those days, the books were closed, by the way, when I was a kid. So,
What do you mean the books were closed?
In other words, well, Carlo Gambino closed the books because...
What does that mean?
Closing the books means that nobody can be made because they were afraid of snitches and the mob was a little up in a turmoil. So they wanted to make sure there were no new members being made.
To kind of close ranks.
Right, right. But I was doing everything in my power to be noticed. So you get noticed, and then what happens is you have a sponsor. The guy that puts you under his wing, he says to you, hey, look, you do business with me. You take care of things for me. You know, and he watches you, and he grooms you, and he teaches you stuff. And when the day comes, the books are open, you'll talk to these people, and they say, I got a guy that's worthy of being made. He's a good guy. He worked for me. He's not a snitch. He takes a trimming. He's a solid guy.
What does taking a trimming mean?
Taking a trimming is you can catch a beating. Like, you know, let's say the cops grab you. And back in the day, they used to kick the shit out of you when they caught you, you know. And they didn't like Italians. And I used to get busted, always in an Irish precinct. And they used to beat the shit out of us. So you take a trimming. You keep your mouth shut. And if you can keep your mouth shut, that's a big thing. And so what happened is I'd get out. And the next thing you know, you're being groomed, you know. And I was doing real good. And then what I would do is do something stupid, like be in a bar with some guys and start a fight and bring heat on my friends. And they
unnecessarily.
And they would reprimand me and smack. I got smacked around by my own people. You know, I was always fighting. We'd go to the headline on 8th Avenue. We'd go there dressed to kill. Silk suits, alligator shoes, I mean, long collar shirt, everything custom made.
How much were you spending on your clothes at that time?
Oh, my God. I had thousands, thousands and thousands of dollars. We used to buy our clothes at Layton's, Phil Cromfeld, Simon, Barney's.
This is thousands of dollars in what year?
This is going back 1963, 64, 65, 66.
Which would be about $20,000 in clothes today, or $50,000.
And you get your gold, you get your cufflinks.
We used to buy a full gaiter for $300. Today, a full gaiter is $2,000.
What's a full gaiter?
Well, meaning the whole shoe is alligator. I always criticize these mob movies, like, you know, Goodfellas. And, yeah, they're going to spend a little extra money on, and you know,
they don't dress well enough.
The long collars and Goodfellas. The old timers used to wear them down to here. We used to wear the short long collars, you know.
Oh, the short long collars. I get it. Yeah, that makes sense.
They need to be technically accurate on these things.
What?
They need to be technically accurate on these things.
Well, yeah.
It sounds like
yeah.
You guys
well, if we do, someday it gets to the point of...
Well, yeah, we'll make the show a mob shot. There we go. All right.
Let me tell you, we'll let
the listeners hear.
We had a guy in the Fort Ward that you'd walk in, a little Jewish guy, and you'd walk into his store, and he had slabs of mohair silk, I mean, Di Pioni silk. And we'd pick out, all right, we want that. He'd make a pair of pants with the belt to match the material.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those pants today, you couldn't even touch them for mohair suits, you know, all colors. I mean.
So you're looking immaculate. You're going into these bars and clubs and then.
Oh, we go in there dressed to kill. I mean.
Literally.
Dressed to kill. Within 5 minutes, somebody'd start a fight. And next thing you know, you look like when you went through a shredder. You know, and that's the way it was.
And they didn't like that. Your crew didn't like that you caused fights and were drawing attention.
We got reprimanded. In fact, let me tell you something. We had a fight once in there. And these were friends from Italian Harlem. A girl always started the fight. A girl had a fight with this guy from Little Italy. Boom, boom, boom. The next thing you know, see, you can hear a fight. You don't even have to see a fight. It's the way the feet hit the floor, the way they rub against the floor. And then you know there's a fight. And you're in there fighting. And we messed that place up. That place was owned by guys from downtown and uptown. And I'm going to tell you something. We wrecked that place. And we were fighting our own friends. And we got hurt. And they hurt. They got hurt. And we got called uptown and downtown. And they beat the shit out of us. Not only that, but we had to pay for all the damage. It was a good thing because we were good thieves. So we made the money. But... I mean, I'm a type of guy. You slap me in the face, I'm going to try and kill you. And if a wise guy slaps you in the face and you go at him, you're a dead man.
So you learn to control your behavior
with them, yeah, them. With them. Yeah.
The
with
rage
them.
Meant power, and power means respect.
And they humiliate you. They'd methodically slap you, like, you know, methodically, and talk to you while they're slapping you. You know, they want you to make a move, and then you're dead man. You know?
Well, I definitely think that the law enforcement community, the federal government, has shifted its focus away from the mafia. There are a lot fewer major organized crime indictments than there once were, even 3-4 years ago.
So I wanted to kind of get back. We were talking about being made and getting made. And I wanted, what is the difference between not being a made man and getting made? I mean, once you cross that threshold, what does that mean? Why is it so valuable?
All right. When you're not being made, you're an associate, and you're associate with made guys, and there's more associates than there are made guys.
It's like a pyramid, right?
Yeah, pyramid. What happens is the associate kicks up money to the made guy. Okay, now the made guy, you're under his wing. So let's say you're pulling a scam downtown, and let's say this guy's from Brooklyn. Brooklyn, they want to come in and they want to cut into your action. And you turn around and say, "Hey, I'm with so and so." You know, they say, "We don't give a fuck." You go back to your man. Your man gets in contact with their people and tells them, "Hey, this guy's with me. This is our thing," and they settle it. See? You get the protection of the made guy, meaning that you can go and do anything you want as long as you're not in another guy's territory. But they can't cut into you if you're doing something where they're not involved. Mm-hmm. If they try and cut into your action, you're protected by your guy. Now, the made guy gets money. See, basically, a made guy uses an associate. I mean, they fuck you real good. I mean, we'd put down scores where we should have gotten thousands and thousands of dollars. They give you what they want, but you have their protection.
Which is worth a huge amount.
It's
right?
worth it because if you, let's say you take a pinch, you can buy your way out of that, you know.
You mean you get arrested?
Oh yeah, in fact, I got arrested where I wasn't even booked, but it cost me a small fortune. But the made guys, they take it. It's almost like a pimp that looks out for his prostitutes,
right.
Except we get treated better than, you know what I'm saying? So he kicks up the made guy, kicks it up to his skipper. Skipper is what they call capo regime. He's got like 10 guys under his wing that are made guys. The made guys may have 100 associates. Now the skipper kicks it upstairs. He kicks it upstairs to the consigliere, the underboss, and the main chunk of the money goes to the boss of the family, like the five families. You got Genovese, you got Bonanno, you got Gambino, you got Lucchese, and
Colombo.
And those are the top. Of course, they're not the guys there now. They just use their name. And the skipper, the head guy gets most of the money. So it's like a pyramid.
Yeah.
So
below the associates, who's below that?
Pardon?
Who's below the associates?
Oh, the associate uses guys too.
Yeah.
You know,
so,
because there's a million kids that want to hang out with tough guys.
They're kind of like the foot soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
They'll
do anything for you. I mean, they'll kill for you. Let's say I'm an associate. I tell a guy, "Hey, do this." Oh, yeah. They can't wait to do it. There's 100 guys that want to do it for you.
Yeah.
When did you go from being sort of a runner for an associate to becoming an associate to be like vying for a position as a made guy?
Well, let me put it to you this way. I always considered myself. I just when people were starting to notice me, I would do something stupid and go down the bottom of the ladder. And it never failed. And then it got to the point where, you know, they went like this to me. "Hey, you're good people. You're a moneymaker." Their hand was this way. I never could get that close. I accepted it because I was crazy. If I drank and put a little cocaine in me, I could rip a place apart. And they didn't like that. They didn't like that at all. And it happened out here, too. You know, I was with them out here. And there was a time in the Tony Romans out here where I started. These guys were looking at us and grinning, and I was coked up. I went over there and I busted the whole table up. And the guy was with, I thought he was going to kill me. You know, he was a Jewish guy, but he was in with the made guys out here. And he threw me over. He had a Stutz Bearcat. He threw me over the car and he grabbed me by the throat. And he says, "I ought to kill you, you fuck." He said, "I told you not to start anything because the FBI were always on top of us."
And those guess FBI what? Agents, huh?
They get everywhere.
I'm going to tell you a story about the FBI. Everywhere we went, they were following us. So I told this guy, his name was Bobby Kessler. He's dead now. And he always was talking about rats. He had a thing for this guy, Jimmy Fratiano, because Jimmy Fratiano was part of the L.A. crew. "That fucking rat, when we get him, keep your eyes open. We get that rat." He never stopped with this Fratiano. Fratiano was a real mafioso, too, but he couldn't take it no more, and he flipped, you know.
So he turned and gave evidence to the FBI?
He was the real deal, this guy. He was all, these guys out here, they call it the Mickey Mouse Club. I mean, I could go on and on with them, but you don't want to. So what happens, I'm sober 2 years now. And I look at the L.A. Times. Bob Kessler rats out Los Angeles Cosa Nostra from San Diego to L.A. And I was sober at the time, and my heart started to beat because I did business with this guy. I was a small-time punk, you know. That wasn't and I called my ex-wife. I said, Linda, you know, this guy drops a dime on me. I'm fucked. And she says, "Please, you're just a small-time guy." She says, he went after the big fish. And his deathbed confession, he ratted out everybody. And he had throat cancer, which I believe, because he smoked one cigarette after another, after another, after another. I mean, I'll tell you, want to hear a God shot? This is a God shot. We're in the Donatello's Italian restaurant on San Vicente Boulevard. And I'm with Bobby Kessler. And that night, I was the good guy. In other words, I was babysitting this guy. Because when he drank, he was crazy like me. He'd want to kill people.
So you were the designated...
I was the designated crazy man that night. Okay. So this is what he said to me. Now, there was a restaurant down the street called Gatsby's. Now, Gatsby's, ironical, was in New York City on 49th Street. We used to park cars for this guy. And Bill Rosen was the guy that was the owner of Gatsby's in New York and L.A. In fact, I ran into him out here in L.A. and I started cutting his hair. So we're in Donatello's one night, me and Bobby, and he's drunk. And he's abusing the waiters and everything. And I said, you know, what the? And I'm there with this guy. And I had my piece with me. I used to carry a shoulder holster. I mean, you know, fucking nutcake, you know?
Self-diagnosed. I
was a real piece of fucking work, let me tell you. Okay. So Bobby says...
You got your shoulder holster.
So Bobby says to me, "That fucking Bill Rosen, that fucking..." And he was going... He was building a mountain out of a snowball. He says, "Hey, are you with me?" I says, "Yeah, Bobby, what do you want?" "Let's go down to Gatsby's." We open the door and we start shooting the fucking place up. I say, "You out of your fucking mind?" He says, "No, are you with me?" I says, "Yeah, stupid me." I says, "Oh, this is it." I says, "Looks like I'm going to get killed or I'm going to go to prison." I said, "But I'm with him." Mm. Right? We go down there and my heart is palpitating and I got my hand on my gun and I'm saying, "Well, we're going to go in there. And now Bill Rosen's wife's brother is a made guy.
Right. And you're going to hit.
And we're going to hit everything. We got anything that's in there, we're going to shoot." It was closing time. You know, we go down there, and I look at Bobby. I go to open the door. It's locked. It's fucking locked. And I said, "There is a God." And Bobby goes, "That fucking, what do you mean? Keep hitting that door." "Bobby, this is an omen," I said. And I talked to him out. I said, "It's an omen. I said, you know," and he said, "Well, we'll get on tomorrow." I said, "No, Bobby, you know, think about it." The next day, guess what? He was in a blackout, which I remember being in myself, and he forgot about the whole thing.
What do you mean a blackout?
In other words, he was alcohol. So fucked up that he did things that night that the next day he didn't remember.
It's like you're walking in a dream.
And you want to know something? This guy's in state prison today that woke up in a cell, and they said, "What am I here for?" "Oh, you killed someone." And they go to prison for the rest of their lives. And that almost happened to me a lot of times. But the next day, he says to me, "What do you mean?" I says, "Did you know what we last?" "No, what?" He says, "You wanted to go in there. You wanted to light the place up." "What are you talking about?" I said, "Bill Rosen." I said, "Oh, are you fucking kidding me?" You know?
So you call it a gotcha.
Gotcha, and, yeah.
And so that's sort of like God intervening in your life.
God intervened because I would have been here. My daughter would have been born. I wouldn't have met Gary Bryan, which is a mortal sin. I wouldn't have met you. I mean, you know, there's so many stories. I tell you, you listen to this thing, and you got to know.
Yeah, I heard
this
one.
This thing
that
you mean, Mob Shot with Vince Giacchino.
God.
On Audible Books.
Oh. Well, you basically say that these God shots prevented you from ending up in prison. So I really want to know what the tipping point was for
you.
And I really want to get into that.
So, Jim, what are you doing June 9th, 10th, and 11th?
I, like everybody else who's into crime, I'm going to be at CrimeCon. CrimeCon 2017 is Comic-Con for crime.
Mm.
Real Crime Profile will be there. We will be doing a live podcast from CrimeCon 2017.
So that's right. It's taking place in Indianapolis. Hopefully some of our Real Crime Profile fans can make it out and come
awesome.
To a live podcast. And there's a great lineup of people appearing.
My brother Tim Clemente and I will be hosting CrimeCon. We will be introducing all the different celebrities and speakers that will be there. And I think there's going to be some interesting people there because not only do we have Nancy Grace, but F. Lee Bailey and actually the prosecutor from the Making a Murderer case.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Mr. Kratz.
Yes.
Mr. Kratz.
Yes. It'd be very interesting to talk to him.
So check out the website www.crimecon.com and you'll see the whole schedule.
And our listeners can get 20% off the top on any tickets by using the promo code REALCRIME20. REALCRIME, the number 20. On top of that, if you go as a group,
they give you a further discount as well. So it's worth looking on our Twitter feed at Real Crime Profile without the E.
And we can't wait to meet you and talk to you and actually do a live podcast right from CrimeCon 2017 live.
Like Preet Bharara said 2 years ago, the mob will do whatever it can to make money. And if they can move into new things, they definitely will. Credit card fraud is one. And most recently, they're into this Medicare, health care fraud, which made them a lot of money. I mean, basically, they had doctors prescribing pain creams, which cost maybe $3 to manufacture, and they were getting reimbursed for $200 to $300. And there's a lot of money there for the mob to take a piece of. Anything they can take a piece of, they will.
So I really want to know what the tipping point was for
Absolutely.
You, and I really want to get into that.
Absolutely.
So Vince, tell us about what the tipping point was. What turned you and made you change?
Well, this is like sort of profound. What happened was the bottom line when I really really changed is my ex-wife. We had this little baby, 10 months old, and my ex-wife had it with me. The broken promises, you know, alcoholics. I'm an alcoholic. I'm in recovery. Alcoholics love to lie and they love to make promises that don't amount to nothing. And she took the baby. She says, I was in the program for a while. And then one day it shows you the disease of alcoholism is resting on your shoulder and is doing push-ups, just waiting for a chance to get you again. So I wasn't going to meetings and I'm home with the baby. And I'm trying to watch a movie. I didn't have a DVR in those days, so I always fall asleep watching a movie. So I'm there watching the baby, and my ex-wife had gone out, and the little disease said to me, yeah, nobody's kid's sleeping. Go to the liquor store, get two of them Manhattans in the cans, which are deadly. Hey, nobody will know the difference. And I did that, and sure enough, she came home, and I used mouthwash, and she'll never know. The minute she walked in the door, she looked at me from across the room and she says, you've been drinking. I said, what are you talking? And I felt like a rat cornered. So I went at her and she took off and she left me there with the baby for 3 days. And I changed that baby, fed that baby. I was in a blackout, but the baby was taken care of. When she came back 3 days later, I was on the floor. I had drank 60 of those Manhattans in cans in 3 days.
60.
And you want to hear
and
the funny?
You took care of a baby during that time?
Yes.
I was taking care of the baby, and the baby was protected and fed and everything.
Hang on, go back. You said that when she said you'd been drinking, you said you went at her.
I went at her, like, you know, because she caught me, and I went to grab her, and she took off and left me with the baby. Now, when she came home, I was laying on the bathroom floor, and she says, I can't, I love you, but I'm leaving you. She says, I'm not going to have my daughter. It's ironical because she's an alcoholic, my ex-wife. Started drinking after I got sober.
But did you strike her? Did you hit her?
I didn't hit her. No, I was going to hit her because she caught me. You know, like a rat. You corner a rat, they'll attack you.
What made you stop? Why didn't you hit her?
Because she ran out the door. I was no angel. I'm not going to lie to you.
No, we want to hear it.
We went out with girls in the neighborhood. We smacked them. They smack you back, and they come at you with a knife. We didn't fool around with no little pussy girls that would cry, you know. And my ex-wife was pretty tough, too. But when she came back, she saw me on the floor, and I heard those words, I'm leaving you. I'm not going to raise my daughter in an alcoholic home. And I could actually hear bells in my head going off. My head was broken open and everything. And
as in, you'd hit your head. You were drunk. You hit your head.
Okay, but let me tell you what happened. Then I did everything in my power to keep her home, not to leave me, because I always did that. And she would lock me out of the house, but I always got back in her graces. I was a con man. It didn't work this time. And I want you to hear this now. See, to say, dear Lord, help me. Help me to stop. I was sleeping, and all of a sudden something happened where I got this profound feeling in my heart. It was, God was saying, I hope you stop drinking. God was saying to me, it's over. You're not drinking anymore, and you're going to change your life. It was so profound that it was like if I hit the lottery. And it was God. It really was God, because it wasn't a thought from me. It was profound. It was like, that's it, man. Party's over. Party's over. You ain't doing nothing. So I woke her up. I said, Linda, you have no idea. And she says, good, thank God. I'm proud of you, but I'm still leaving. I said, but you don't understand. You don't. And that was it. And another thing happened while I was, why I started actually changing my life then. I went back to meetings, started sponsoring people, went to took commitments, went on panels, and I worked my way back into changing my life. And that was God. Because you know how many times I'd say, I'm going to stop. It was like he invisibly grabbed me and shook me and said, listen, you little shithead, this is it. You're done. You're finished. And that was the turning in my life. And then, you know, you ever hear of the white light syndrome?
Mm-hmm.
You know what the white light is? I'm sleeping one night, and I'm having a dream, right? But it's not a dream. The light goes on in my room, and I figure, fuck it, I'm being burglarized. And I remember in the dream, I was saying, well, I guess it's your turn to get robbed, you know? And there was a voice in back of this light, and it was a thunderous voice, and I couldn't understand what it was, but it was loud, and it was like, and when I woke up, I realized, wait a minute, there's no light here, and there's nobody in my room. And I started to feel enlightened. And, I mean, I felt so good, I can't even tell you. And the next day, I went to a meeting, and people were coming up to me and saying, what's wrong? What's going on with you? I said, what? He says, you don't have that shitty attitude no more. You're easier to talk to.
One day they noticed it?
They noticed it as time went by. I didn't notice it, but I felt better, and I felt more non-hateful. I had a lot of hate inside of me like you wouldn't believe, and I started to feel enlightened, you know? And that was the two God shots, that feeling when God said, this is it for you, and then the white light. And I had both of them. So I'm saying, this is no joke. This guy upstairs he's stepping into your life. That's why you never got killed in auto accidents and getting arrested. And he wanted to punish you. Yeah, I did little Mickey. I did time out here for Marx, 30 days here, 60 days in Mira Loma. But the stuff I was dealing, cocaine and all that shit, I would have got caught. I would have gone away forever. So it was like he was making me suffer, but he doesn't. It wasn't like he was saying, I'm going to incarcerate you for the next 40 years. It was like, I'm going to hurt you and make you suffer, but eventually I'm going to put you on the right path. Because I look at it this way. God takes the dredges of society and he makes them his soldiers. And I'm a fucking general. Believe me when I tell you that, what I've been through. And that's the way it was. And I've been sober now 29 years.
Congratulations. Yeah. That is a big deal.
And then in between that, you know, after I was sober and I got sober, you know, I went to a meeting one time. This is the real God shot. I mean, this one, you can't believe this one. I'm in a meeting and I'm looking at these people in the meeting. I'm going, these fucking, look at these. Don't they know who I am? I'm a fucking, I hung with the best of the best. Look at these guys. I wouldn't even do drugs with, you know, because everybody's in that meeting, you know, all kinds, rich, poor, and I'm judging them. And I'm thinking, you know what, fuck this. And I said, I'm going to leave the meeting. I had 10 months. This was after the baby was gone with the mother and everything. I was a good daddy and everything, but I said, I need a break. I said, I'm going to go home, get dressed up. I said, I'm going to do some coke, drink, and I'm gonna get laid tonight because I'm going to call some people. And as I'm walking out the door, listen to this. This guy with long hair down to here, I wouldn't even want to associate with. He had a Fu Manchu mustache. And as I'm walking out the door to go home and do my little trip, he calls my name. He says, Vince. I turn around. I look at him. He says to me, you're Vince? I says, yeah. I'm looking at him like, what the fuck does he want? He says, would you sponsor me? I says, sponsor you? And I'm thinking, what? Why the fuck would he want my? See, I had this grandiose behavior, but I still had a low self-esteem. And I'm thinking, what do I got to give this guy? You know, he kept me in the parking lot for 3 hours. And after the 3 hours, I said, yeah, I'll sponsor you. And I was giving my sponsor a hard time at the time, and he was ready to dump me. And I said to him, Joey, this guy, Joey was an ex-mob guy, by the way. I said, Joey, this guy asked me to sponsor. He said, he had this gravelly voice. He said, well, sponsor him. I said, what do I know about sponsor? He said, I'll help you. But this guy took commitments at every meeting. And he called me every minute of the day. And you know something? He worked a better program than I even imagined. And my ego at first said, hey, I got to catch up to this guy. And it was all ego. But then I did it with a real good heart. And then I started sponsoring other people, and I started doing commitments, and I started, I had panels. I took a panel at the women's shelter. I kept it for 8 years. Helped a lot of women that were beaten up by their husbands. And in other words, my legacy today, when I die, is not how much money I got. I don't have money. I make a living. All these clothes I wear, they're bought and paid for a long time ago. I couldn't even afford these clothes. I make a living. My legacy is how many people was I able to help in this world before I die. That's the legacy. That's the legacy I want to leave today. Not guys I stuck guns in their faces and robberies and all the bullshit. That's all bullshit. How many people did I touch today? And you know what? That's why all these good things happen in my life. And I was always a hustler, always trying to con you to give me this, give me that, always working for it. And I don't work for anything. It seems that all the good things in my life today happen because I turn up be a fucking human being.
Yeah.
You turned it around.
Of course you do. Which is why I invited you here today, Vince, and I know that we've had conversations before. We've had conversations about all this stuff, but we've also had conversations about the victims of your crimes and the crimes of the people that you were around. And just so the listeners know, Vince didn't ever kill anybody. He didn't go crazy.
I came close to it.
Yeah, I know.
I came close to it.
But you didn't. And
thank God.
Thank God.
Thank the Lord, man.
But how do you feel now about the victims of your crimes?
Yeah, Yeah, I have remorse. I have remorse. You know, you go into a person's house and you invade their privacy. You know, I see it on television now, you know. And I see guys talking about home invasions. And my first thought is, oh, these fucking guys. And then I say, whoa, whoa, you were doing that, you know. You weren't doing that when you were younger with no impunity. I'll tell you a story. Gotshot number 50. So me and this kid, Jimmy Zaffarisi, Zap, he was up in Coxsackie with me. Zap was like a...
Could you tell the listeners what Coxsackie is?
Okay, Walter Winchell during the Korean War said his statement, if your son's in Korea, you send them a package. If your son is in Coxsackie, you send them a prayer. It's a reformatory. The yard in Coxsackie is all divided into properties. And you got the real badasses on the back wall, and then you got the guys that are half-ass guys, then you got in the middle all the guys that are the creeps, the rats and everything. So we're on the back wall. Most of us were Italian. And those guards, we had targets on our back. Every chance they got, they'd jack us up. Then they throw you in the hole. And then if you really fuck up, they put you in what they call an assign, where they put you on the coal gang for 3 months before they send you back to population. I did 3 of those stints, and I was always in trouble, always in trouble.
How long were you in there for?
I did the whole 3 years. I
didn't straight, make, 3 years?
Straight 3. But it was a youthful offender. Youthful offenders, I didn't have a record when I got out of there.
Right, mm-hmm. But
they had record that I was up there, believe me, because when I got involved in other stuff, it came up that I was in Coxsackie.
But you were telling us about Jimmy Farisi.
Okay, Jimmy Zaffarisi was my boy, and I memorized all the names of the guys that were up there with me because I was going to look them up. They told me that's how I got an intro to meeting mob guys, because these guys that were up there, their uncles or fathers were made guys or associates, and they said, I want you to, because I had a rep up there that I could take a trim and I could keep my mouth shut, and I did a lot of stuff up there for a skinny little kid. So when I got out, I had this reputation. So I met all these guys, right? So Zaffarisi was one of my boys up there, big, muscle-bound guy. But there was the thing about Zaffarisi, I could sort of manipulate him in a way, you know? I mean, he was bad news. And I remember one time I didn't get his number, and I was so pissed off. I says, fuck. I says, Zaffarisi, I didn't have... So we were nightclubbing, you know, and we went up to the Peppermint Lounge, I'm 45th Street, and next door is the Wagon Wheel. So the Wagon Wheel, we go in the Wagon Wheel, and who's the bouncer? Jimmy Zapp. And we hugged and everything, and the next thing you know, of course, we were like this. And then in the daytime, we would, you know, we'd get together, we'd go to the beach, and I said to him, Zapp, I said, you know, and that's where I was doing drugs again. So, and I wasn't really meeting guys at that time. Yeah, sort of, you know. And I said, Zapp, why don't we do this? At night, we'll hit big houses in Cherry Hill and in Long Island Estates, and the daytime we go to the beach. And we did this. We got drugs, girls, and everything. And at night, we would hit these homes. So one night, this was in the Jamaica Estates, and we'd ring the bell. I'd ring the bell, and the woman would open up the door. She'd see an innocent guy, and I'd go, I say, excuse me, ma'am. I says, do you know of this? As soon as I could put my foot in the door, I pulled out a gun. And I said, shh, don't make it. Because we never hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. We're very cool about it. We tied her up and everything. And there were 2 people there. We tied them up. And I'm downstairs with them. And all of a sudden, I hear Zaffarisi upstairs. Motherfucker, son of a bitch. So I had a 32, and he had a pea shooter. But he was an awesome figure. I run upstairs in this room. There's guns on the wall. Rifles, they were drawers with ammo. They were knives. They were pistols. The whole room was filled with arms.
Wow.
And I said, what the fuck? And I ran downstairs. I said, lady, what's going on? Oh, she says, my husband is a gun collector. He's with the police department. He's a sharpshooter. I said, what? I said, where is he? And he said, oh, he'll be home. I said, lady, don't lie to me because you'll really get it. No, he won't be home for a while. I said, Zap, let's get the fuck. We got sheets from their beds and we put everything. We had a truck, a open back truck. We've put everything in the back. We probably $100,000, $200,000 worth of guns. And we took off. And I said to Zap, I said, Zap, if that guy would have been home, the minute I walked in that door, he would have put one right through my head. I says, you know, we got to be more careful. He said to me, well, you're the one that's always setting up these fucking scores. And then I realized, I said, you know what? I said, I better get with the program here because, and I stopped doing that. And then I got involved being associated more. And see, it was a joke with me. It was like a yo-yo. I'm going to, oh, you're getting up there. And then I do drugs and out. And in other words, there was something that was pulling me down that was saying, wait a minute, no, 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 no. You're not going to get made. You're going to fuck up. Then you can work your way up again. Oh, no, no. We're going to go. And this was going on forever, like a yo-yo. And it was very painful, especially the drug thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. You talked about your low self-esteem at that time, which, yeah. You know, although you kind of were the big guy in you know, some senses, you felt...
I had illusions of grandeur, but I always had a low self-esteem. And then after a while, Zaporizhzhia, because all I wanted to do was steal. Steal, steal, steal. I was addicted to stealing. I love to steal. Zaporizhzhia said to me one day, he says, you know, I'm with my girl now. And I says, I want out. I don't want to do this shit no more. And I tried conning him. And he said, look, he says, do you hear what I said? I says, we're not doing this anymore. Now, he could have broken me in half, this guy. He would have hit me. I would have felt it in Chicago. That's how hard this guy could hit. And even though he listened to me, he made it clear to me, don't want any of your bullshit. It's over. And I was heartbroken because he was my crime partner, and I loved the guy. He says, get yourself a fucking girl. He says, fall in love. He says, you got all these girlfriends, and you treat them wrong, and you, why don't you just care for somebody? And I didn't know how. I'd go to a good girl. They loved me. I had a way about me. I always had the good girls. And I didn't know how to treat them because, see, my mother and I, we had a very bad relationship. And she turned me into the cops many times, and I never trusted a woman. So my motto was, I'll do it to them before they do it to me, which is bullshit. I'm 75 years old now. I think I could still go out with a girl. If I went with a girl today, I know how to treat her. But, you know, when I had the opportunity to meet a really, I was married 3 times. I mean, my first wife tried to kill me. I mean, her father was a bookie. You know, she was bad news. But the last 2 wives were angels. And that's my remorse. My remorse is the way I treated them. I had no respect for them. I'd go out, cheat on them, come home when I wanted to.
How did you learn to love them and be connected to them?
My program taught me how to love. My program taught me how to care for other people. And if I was to be with a woman today, I would know how to treat her, you know? And I never did. I was a selfish, egotistical asshole. I was a real pretty boy. So, you know, girls came easy. And the ones we went out with were crazy like us. So the combination of being a cutie pie and being a crazy man, you get all the nut jobs you want.
Dangerous combination. It's a dangerous combination, and when you operate from fear and
you know what the word peeling the onion is? My sponsor was an ex-mob guy. In fact, do you know the movie Vin Diesel, Find Me Guilty?
Yeah,
it's talking about he rats out. My sponsor shot his cousin Jackie DeNasio, who Vin Diesel played, and there's a book called The Boys from New Jersey, and I didn't notice till my sponsor died. He died from AIDS, you know, dirty needle. He ratted out the whole Lucchese family. And it's the movie with Vin Diesel. And that was my sponsor. And he peeled my onion. You know, he said to me when I first got sober, I was a real cutie pie. You know, the girls all liked me in the program. And he says to me, he says, you think you're hot shit, don't you? I said, you know, he says, you're a real tough guy, aren't you? I said, yeah, I can handle myself. He says, you're a tough guy. He said, you're a scared little fucking kid. That's what you are. He says, you're afraid to let people know that you're not a tough guy, so you put on all this act. And I got real mad at him. And I said, what are you fucking talking about? I can handle it. Yeah, he says, you can fight, but you're deep inside, you're scared to death. Mm. And he says, you're a real ladies man, aren't you? I said, yeah, well, you know, I had women. And he said, yeah, he says, what kind of woman do you have? I said, well, beautiful woman. He said, no. What was their character? I said, well, why did they like you? Well, I was a tough guy, and I made money. He says, really? He says, did they like you because you were a good person? Did they like you because you had love in your heart? Did they like you because they were good women themselves? And what the fuck are you talking about? I'm getting mad now. He says, you were no fucking lover. He says, a real woman wouldn't even look at you. I say, you fucking kidding me? He says, that's right. And I went at him. He says, don't play that shit with me. He says, would you want your daughter? How old is your daughter? I said, my daughter is a year old. He says, let me ask you something. Would you want your daughter to go out with someone, pretty boy like you, the same character that you had? Would you like that? Would you like to have her go out with a guy like that? Would you like to have him as your son-in-law? And I thought about it. I said, fuck, I'd kill the bastard.
Yeah.
What a great question to
ask.
And
you want to know something? He really, he was a great sponsor.
So, Vince, I've seen you with your daughter, and I know you really love her. So tell us about that. Tell us about how that was part of your redemption.
You want me to tell you what kind of a father I was?
Well, that you became. Aren't you a good father? Well, don't you have a good relationship with her?
My daughter, when my ex-wife left...
So she did go for good. I mean, when she said she was going,
she left. In the beginning, she situated herself close to. I live by the beach, and she got a condo down by Westwood to be close. So, and in the beginning, we did things together with the kid. And I would go every day to the park. I would see this little baby, and she'd waddle over to me. Da 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 da. I mean, it tore my heart out. Because I can't even tell you how much love I have for this baby. And I'd hug her and everything. And then we started to do things together. We went to the circus, to the zoos, to every amusement park. And the mother and I, we did it together. And, you know, what was sad is the little baby would always try to put my hands on her mother's hands. But we knew I was done with that. I still cared about my ex-wife, but I didn't love her enough to go back with her.
But you were co-parenting together.
Co-parenting. But I would go every day to see the kid, and I would have her on the weekends, keep her for the weekend and do things with her. I mean, I have at home 16 albums filled with pictures from the day she came out of her mother.
No doubt.
Well, that's great. And Vince, we really appreciate you coming and talking to us about Mob Shot with Vince Chiacci. That you can get on audible.com. And
that's right. And if you go to audible.com/realcrime, you can actually get it for free and get signed up for Audible.
Yeah, this is one disc. It's got 20 pot shots in it. We didn't talk too much about the crimes that I did, but there's plenty in there.
Yeah.
You know, but the redemption part is the part that I look at today.
Well, that's the person I know. And,
right.
You know, when I met you at Tony Dennison's house and we talked about New York and back in the day and so forth, and I realized that you're a good man, and I'm glad that you found redemption.
And are leaving a legacy. But, I mean, I just have one last question for you, Vince, which is, what would the advice be to your younger self? If there's any one thing that you would say to your younger self.
To my younger self. My younger self was, I should have put all that energy into positive energy and looked at life different. At those days, I was just a frightened little guy that was afraid to show you that I was frightened, so I had all these walls I would put up. And today, I know who I am today. I know the man I am today. And I'm not that type of guy today. You know, maybe I would tell myself, if I could convince myself, hey, do something good with your life. You don't have to prove anything to anybody. Just be yourself. That's what I probably would tell my younger self today.
I think that's excellent.
Great. Thing. Yeah.
Excellent advice.
Well, thanks again.
And
to our listeners, thanks for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Mob Shot by Vince Chiacci is available on Audible. And Real Crime Profile listeners can get his audiobook in his voice for free with a 30-day trial membership by going to audible.com/realcrime. Again, that's audible.com/realcrime for Mob Shot by Vince Giacci.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.